confines of Hollywood's most exciting house, the Fortress of Fruititude, or the Purpose of Fruititude, located somewhere here in Western United States. Once again, we join hands and join hearts. First of all, I'm going to say this about the smartest man in the world, Proopcast. Hillary started it, and I end it here today. Okay? President Obama, I didn't think was from Kenya. I thought he was from Covina. That was the theory I was trying to put forward, but no one was going with me on this. Because no one would believe he would shop at the Galleria. My name's Greg Proops. Me amo Gregorio. Asus Ordinez. Thank you for listening. If you're out there in Proopcast land, this is an awesome time to do whatever it is you're going to do. I know that I'm always urging you to drink or smoke or whatever. It is, however, by the way, two things today. It's National Taco Day. As we record this, it's October 4th. It's also National Vodka Day. And I've combined both here, and I am drinking a vodka taco as we speak. Or I'm eating a taco vodka, or whatever. I'm trying to do both at the same time. It was my birthday yesterday. I'm 104. And it's exciting being this age, because you wake up in the morning and you're like, oh my God, a bird. And then you realize that you knew that bird's grandfather. And it gives you a kind of a connection to all of the universe when you walk along the ground and realize that you're as old as pieces of dirt that are laying there, and that you have jokes older than people who listen to the show. And that's the exciting part for me about getting older. That and being alive. That part's good. I'm down with that. And so once again, we join hands here on National Taco Vodka Day, National Vodka. Who decides these, by the way? I go on the interweb like everyone else, and you get up in the morning and you look at the phone or you look at your computer and on Twitter. And of course, there'll be a lot of what was it last week? There was some inane thing about the election, and I think it was, you know, Hillary winning the debate or whatever. And Twitter, because Twitter is, I think, the bottom line for insipid vapidity in this world, said the 2016 election just got a whole lot more interesting. And you're like, if you needed this week to be the week that made you interested in it, wow. Well, up until then, what were you doing? Just making popsicles in your freezer with like little, you know, saguaro shaped cactus trees? What was it you were doing? How were you spending your time? Were you making the Titanic out of balsa wood? I don't know. In any case, yeah, things just got a whole lot more interesting in Proopcast land because I read a book. Let me just cover the dates here before we go any further. By the time this one comes out, you can visit me next week at the Proopcast we'll be doing at the Nerd Melt here in Los Angeles, the hippest comedy room in the entire universe. Right there, located behind a comic book store. That's the 13th. Then the 7th, we'll be back at Bar Lubitsch. That one's free. That's on Santa Monica Boulevard and has a groovy back room and a bar. The Nerd Melt, you're going to have to bring your own booze. What you do is you go to the liquor store next door. Well, it's about three doors down, like they do. And we have a little green room. Well, I would call it a green room, except no one ever wants to touch anything or sit in there. But they have a refrigerator, and so usually there's a bottle of vodka in there. And now lately, I've noticed at the Nerd Melt, they've actually given me a bucket of ice. Ryan and Matt won't be at this one coming up. It'll be Zach at the helm. Ryan is taking a trip. He's finally taken the vow, and he's become a novitiate priest. And I believe he's going to Diego Garcia on the Indian Ocean for his first posting. In any case, we wish him well, and we wish him love. Zach will be there. Zach, you'll recognize because he has a backward baseball hat on, like he's one of the Honeycomb gang. Down to the Honeycomb hideout. The Honeycomb kids are there. Then we'll be at that night. We'll be at the Nerd Melt. That's the 13th, October 13th. Is that a Tuesday? I think it is. Thursday. See, you know what? Time is a concept. And then the 7th, that's a Tuesday. We'll be at Bar Lubitsch. That's, in fact, it's a Monday because it's the day before Election Day. The 8th is Election Day, 11-8, or 8-11 if you're listening in Belgium. And the 7th, of course, will be the day before, and we'll be doing the pre-game, pre-election podcast from there. Then I'll be in Portland, Oregon the week after that on the 17th through the 20th at the Helium, and the podcast will be on the Sunday. That's on the 20th, and we'll be in New York City, and then we'll be going over to Brooklyn on the 25th for the vodcast at the Bell House. Join us there. That's always a wow time. Then we'll probably try to pick up some more podcasts in and around here in LA. There's been a lot of porpoises lately. I know that. So many porpoises that a Greek myth is being built up around me. Dionysus is the new sponsor of the show. That's how many fucking porpoises there are. And then we'll be in Vancouver at Yuck Yucks, the podcast on the 1st of December. And then we'll be there the 2nd and 3rd. Then, of course, we'll be in San Francisco for New Year's weekend. And the podcast will be on Thursday. And then in Vermont at Burlington. And I'm sorry, a guy wrote me and went, "Hey, everyone laughed when you said Burlington Comedy Club. Real cool." And I said, "Don't worry about them. It's just you and me in Burlington." He was mad because everyone laughed in L.A. All the callous sophisticates that were at the Bar Lubitsch went, "Ha, ha, ha." Because I said the Burlington Comedy Club was named the Burlington Comedy Club. And it was eponymous. And then everybody laughed. And he's like, "Hey, man." I'm like, "It's okay, Vermont. We outnumber you here in West Hollywood. Just the people of West Hollywood outnumber you in Vermont." Vermont's cute. It's like a health food store. It really is. It's like there's quinoa and there's beardy people and women wear mandals. It's nice. I like Vermont. It's cute. I've been to Burlington. There's also like, it's like the Revolutionary War happened yesterday in Vermont. There's a statue in every town of a white person named Pete or Richard. And they're marching along and they're very happy and they've got a little hat on and they're going to fight the bloody British. And, you know, no, let's not undersell Vermont's contribution to the Revolutionary War. Ethan Allen, who later, of course, started a chain of furniture stores in honor of the Revolution, came with the Green Mountain Boys from Vermont. And they also made a movie with Franchot Tone. Can't remember who played Ethan Allen in the movie. It slipped my mind. Well, there you go. Join us on our adventures, won't you? Also, Who's Line Anyway? Who's Live Anyway? Is on, yeah, I know. I don't know the name of my own bloody show. We're on the road, and we'll have been in San Francisco this weekend, so thank you. It was so much fun. I had a great time. But then after that, we'll be in Edmonton, Alberta next Saturday at the River Cree Resort. I know, for those of you who live in Alberta, it's not in Edmonton. It's in Enoch. I know the difference. What is it like playing in Enoch, Alberta? Before the show, we go outside, and behind the casino, there's an enormous canola field. And this time of year, there's generally lots of yellow flowers. And then you look up, and the sky's as big as can be. So it's like being on the prairie, and there's you can watch a cat run away for like 3 days. That's how flat it is. But there's lots of flowers, and it's very nice, and the people there are nice. And there's a kind of fancy restaurant at the casino, which isn't that fancy, but by casino standards is considered fancy. It's pretty fun there, I have to say. I love Alberta, and I like playing that casino. The stairway to the stage is like climbing like you're on a nuclear destroyer. It is the most precarious fucking naval staircase to go up to a stage. And we all drink a little bit during the show, sometimes a lot. And that one's treacherous. I remember we played there years ago and they hadn't fixed the room yet. Now it's a little more set up in there, but it was really impromptu. And basically it was on a tarmac and they'd built this crappy staircase and then the staircase getting to the stage. And they go, "Well, we had Joan Rivers here." And I thought, "You're going to kill Joan Rivers on that bloody staircase in her Chanel low heel pumps in her bag." Then we'll be on the 21st of October at the Moore Theater in Seattle, which is fantastic. The last time we played there, we had a lot of celebrities. Eric Idle was in the show the last time we played there. I'm not promising anything. I'm not saying Eric Idle's coming up there. He happened to be there, and he's friends with we're friendly with him, let me put it that way. And he sat in and did story with us at the end. That's a very improv thing to say. For you Mike Birbiglia fans, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Everyone else can go look up what story is. The 22nd will be at Bellingham, Washington. That's Brian's gaff in Bellingham. It's not his gaff. It's near his gaff. We're playing at the university. Then the next night, the 24th, the 23rd rather, on the Sunday, I'll be over doing my Halloween proopcast at his theater, which is the Upfront Theater in Bellingham. So if you go on the Upfront site, I don't know if they've lifted it yet. It's a casual small town feel to the entire affair and very, very saturated in THC. The people who come there are fantastic. I received a donut cat the last time I played Bellingham, which Jennifer and I have been tormenting each other with for a year. How do you mean? Well, the donut cat will appear in different places. That's all I'm saying. When you don't want it to, all of a sudden there's a donut cat. And I thank you. And yes, the guy who gave it to me, his name was Graham, which is a very appropriate name for a town where people sell weed. And then the third will be in Chico at the Laxon Auditorium. Chico is a small principality located about 3.5 hours north of San Francisco, kind of Northern California-y. We always have Mexican food when we play there, so that's something I look forward to. Then the Marin's Veterans Memorial Auditorium in Marin on November 4th, or as our Canadian producer calls it, Marin. Yes, we're playing Mark's House up in Northern California. That's a beautiful venue and has the longest aisles of any theater I've ever played in my life. There's no center aisle, and it holds about 1,500, 2,000 people. So if you sit in the center and you want to get up during the show, or heaven forbid we have a fire like we did last time, I don't know how people get out of there. It's crazy. But beautiful. And you have to leave the building to go from the green room to the stage. So you actually, we eat in one room and get ready, and then we walk around the building and go to the other. It's fantastic. These are the things I miss the most, as Steely Dan said. Then we'll be at Luther Burbank in Santa Rosa, Luther Burbank Center, which I don't think I've played since I lost the comedy competition in 1997 or whatever. I think I got up at Luther Burbank and did an Elvis Costello impression. And Dr. Gonzo, I finished really shitty that night. Dr. Gonzo was hosting. He's a friend of mine. He's a comedian. And he came up to me after the set and went, "Wrong Elvis." And that made me laugh. Then we'll be in Modesto, California, at the Gallo Center for the Arts. The Gallo family bought California in the 19th century and turned it into a slave wine vineyard. And we'll be playing there. At the Mary Stuart Rogers Theater. I don't know who she is, but that's the name of the theater. Sometimes we get there and you're like, what's the name of this place? Then we'll be in Santa Barbara at the Granada. If you've not been to that one, it's on the main drag. It's on Milpas in Santa Barbara. It's such a cute street, right? There's that Mesa's, and then there's that Mexican food place, and then there's the Granada Theater, which looks like a 1920s romance revival. It's got a great big courtyard, and then, you know, all the wrought iron and everything like that. And it's really cute. Santa Barbara is the cutest place in the world. If you have never been, you should really go. And when you go, Los Olivos, or Jennifer, help me, the famous, where Julia Child used to eat all the time. La Super Rica. I don't know why that one slipped my mind. La Super Rica and Los Olivos are literally half a block from each other, maybe. Almost across the street from each other. And you can fight over which one's better. We used to be La Super Rica people. Now we kind of more Los Olivos people. But Olivos? Or am I giving it the wrong name? I probably am. How do I get through life is the question. Why do you call your show The Smartest Man in the World? Why don't you call it The Person with the Worst Short-Term Memory of All Fucking Time? Why are you having an argument with yourself? Why are you doing all these things? But I'll hope to get out to La Super Rica. They make their own tortillas, and their frijoles have bacon in them. So if you're thinking about like taking a holiday, you might go there just because, one thing that bacon does is makes everything better, especially vegetarian dishes. And, Los Agaves. What did I say? Los Olivos? I called it the olives, and it's not. It's the agaves. I would go early. Where are you? I would go 10-ish, 11-ish in the morning. I really like the Pescado Veracruz, but I would go in the many good burritos there, and both are sensational. That's what the thing is. It's just sensational. Then you can go over to this Mission Santa Barbara, which is like a Hollywood version of a mission. It's painted pink, and there's lots of statues and junk and stuff everywhere. And you can read about that wonderful Indian woman who they stranded out on the islands, and then they brought her back to civilization, and she didn't like it, and she died. And it's very good. There's all these islands off the coast of California. I've not been to them because I would have to take a boat, and I would have to. Let me put it this way: the last time I took a boat, I was pressed ganged by Magellan's crew, and I was forced to go around the world for 4.5 years, and I didn't want to do it. And I don't like having bare feet. I don't like scrubbing, and I don't like using the latrine off the bow, the port bow. The Granada Theater is beautiful. Then we'll be in Costa Mesa. That's in Orange County. If you live in Orange County, good for you. Come and join us, won't you? And then Escondido, which is right near San Degraded, that's on November 12th. So yeah, we keep this, the train keeps rolling all night long. We've got a lot of dates. Don't ask me why we're not coming to your neck of the woods. We already did. We already played Michigan, Arizona, and Oregon, and that's about as exotic as it got on this tour. But next year, we're going to go to Canada and hopefully the East Coast and whatnot. So we'll see our friends there. And don't ask me when we're coming to London again. We did London in July with Colin, Brad, Josie, me, Jeff, and Clive, Linda, and Laura. And that was, we've done it 2 years in a row. So no, I don't know if we're coming again. I wish I could tell you. I really, really wish I could. And then, of course, around Halloween time, 28th, 29th, 30th, we'll be at the Hollywood Bowl with Danny Elfman and the entire live presentation of Nightmare Before Christmas with a full orchestra. And yes, you'll see me sing. And when I say see me sing, notice I didn't say you'll listen to me sing. You'll see me, and then I'll be singing. This people write us, and my friend Richard Vaunch, Dr. Richard Vaunch, who you may know from the Super Collider letter of a year, 2 years ago. Why did you quote Richard about a super collider and physics? Because he's a doctor of physics from Cambridge. What does he do for a living? Tells dick jokes. So he's a little more overqualified than you to fucking hold the position that he holds. He could be teaching at Cambridge as a doctor of physics. Why did he quit teaching physics? Because he said he didn't want to make nuclear fucking bombs. That was the reason he gave me. I think he met some nuclear people at a party once and went like, this isn't for me. You know what I like? Drinking and hanging out with comics. He sent me this, and a bunch of you did too. Thank you very much. I got a lot of emails, faminfogreg@gmail.com. A lot of you sent it to me. Some of you tweeted it to me, and I have all your stories. And yes, it's a wild boar story as they go. But this time we're switching it up, and we're not going to play Wild Boars by Duran Duran. We're going to play Piggies by the Beatles. That's my idea of switching it up. Let's see here. Eurostar passengers experienced delays after a train hit a wild boar that had strayed onto the track. The 1422 from London St. Pancras to Paris Gare du Nord was delayed for about an hour Sunday. Where's their parade? That's what I'd like to know. The people who were taking the Eurostar from Paris to Gare du Nord had their train delayed for an hour because they hit a wild boar on the tracks. Now, Jennifer and I have taken the Eurostar many times, and I've never seen any pigs nearby. But mind you, when you come out of the tunnel, when you're on the British side, it goes slow. It's such a story of two countries. When you're on the British side, the food is shitty, and the atmosphere is awful and dank and hideous. St. Pancras Station is like a mental hospital in Romania in the 30s, right? People are wandering around. There's pigeons inside. There's a terrible baguette place that I can't think of the name of that's just beyond. The baguettes don't even resemble baguettes. And then you get in the train, and you're whisked to France. Well, you go through the tunnel, and then you come out the other side, and all of a sudden the train's doing 1,000 miles an hour and clipping along, and the food got good. I don't know what happened, where they changed it out in the tunnel or whatever. And the Gare du Nord station, well, I don't know if it's anything to write home about. Sadly, it's not as, but it's such a, as soon as you get out of Gare du Nord, well, last time we were there, they were like, oh my God, there's a taxi strike. You can't take a taxi. So we walk over to a taxi that's sitting there and we're like, are the taxis on strike? He's like, I'll take you. And I'm like, well, what kind of taxi strike is this? This is not a taxi strike. This is a taxi insurrection with basically lassitude. It was just like some of them didn't feel like riding. They were mad about Uber at the time. They were mad about Uber, and quite rightly. Because Uber was cutting into their bag. It's very difficult to flag a taxi in Paris, but they sit in ranks, right? They're very organized in Paris. A bureaucracy they invented. And that was just authentic pig noises. That was George Martin, I assume, or the genius of Jeff Emmerich. And so we got a taxi anyway, but the Eurostar is great fun, and it moves like the very wind. A Eurostar spokesman said it led to minor delays. He said the train arrived safely. The collision caused a few delays. I'm assuming the wild boar perished in this accident and is survived by two piglets. There are many wild boars in that area which can take it. I love spokesman for Eurostar. Which can take it upon themselves to roam from their area onto the track. Hey, I've got an idea. Maybe you built the track on their area. That ever fucking grab you, Mr. Spokesperson? That the track was where the wild pig roams, and that maybe they were like, you know, I used to run across here every once in a while. Let me just see if I can still, oh shit. That's what happens. It's understood no one was injured, but there's been no further information about the wild boar. Well, the wild boar is sausage now. Services appear to be running as normal, blah, blah, blah. And then Erin sent me this. Her Twitter handle is at EMR869, San Jose, California. This is from the Channel 2 website in the Bay Area. If you're from the Bay Area, you know what Channel 2 is, KTVU. For years and years, it was a newscaster there named Dennis Richmond was their 11 o'clock newscaster. And Dennis Richmond didn't read you the news. He scolded you because you didn't know it already. That was his delivery. You go, I'm Dennis Richmond, and this is the KTVU News in Washington today. And you're like, ah, Dennis, I'm sorry, I didn't study. Wild boars are at it again, tearing up lawns in a San Jose neighborhood. Homeowners said the pigs aren't just a nuisance, but a safety concern. The pigs are coming from a vast open space area and are active at night. Pig or zombie apocalypse? It's becoming quite a mess in San Jose's East Foothills. They say the damage is caused by hungry wild boars. When you see this much damage, it's obvious the pigs, that it, that's the pigs, and it's definitely more than one pig, said Ron Cooper Smith of San Jose. Ron Cooper Smith's lawn is one of more than a handful hit in the last week, some repeatedly, and he considers himself lucky. His lawn is not as bad as his neighbors on Running Springs Road. He said a pack of feral pigs are coming from ranch land across the street. As it keeps getting more and more dry, there's less food for them out there. So they come in here, and they're grubbing. They're looking for grub. Looking for worms. They're looking for fucking trouble, and they found it with you, Coop. A few years back, neighbors reinforced a fence with barbed wire. Can you do that? Can you just put up barbed wire in your neighborhood? That seems a little crazy, white people, for me. If we put up barbed wire here, we're in our neighborhood, people would be like, what's happening? Why don't you just put up Klieg lights and say that we're keeping this Stalag Proopteen? Jesus H. But they suspect the pigs found a hole. One neighbor's resorting to a flashing red lights to scare them away. You're joking. Flashing red lights don't scare animals. Look, we have raccoons here in Los Angeles, and you can go up to a raccoon and shout in its face and show it a picture of a dead raccoon, and it will just scoff at you. They really don't react. And you know who really doesn't react? Possums. Possums really, really don't care about humans at all. They don't interact with us. If I've chased one with a broom before. I've hosed one with a hose, and they barely noticed. I mean, if an animal whose idea of running away from you is falling on the ground and pretending it's dead, you really can understand that it has no issues with you. It's not afraid of you. It's not interested in you. Are you some corn? I think is what a possum's thinking. Are you a can of cat food? If you are, then we can chat. Grubbing for worms with red lights. The deuce, you say. Brian Hahn is worried about his dog. I'm going to do my impression of Brian Hahn, although I don't know him. I walk Chloe, our little dog, out here in the morning and night. I have some fears if the boar started attacking her. What'd I do? Well, they can be very violent, said Andy Pangelina of Creature Catchers. I call bullshit on Creature Catchers. They will charge right at you. Hell yeah, they will. That's the thing about wild pigs. They're not like raccoons, and they're not like possum. Raccoons aren't benign, but they don't usually come screaming at you and attack, unless it's the movie Prophecy. But wild pigs are decidedly something you don't want to fuck with. Unless you're at that beach in the south of France near Spain, where they just bathe and everybody walks around and has a good time and pets them, and they look like little watermelons. Andy Pangelina is a licensed trapper, he said. Pigs are active this time of year, fattening up for the winter. In California? What winter? This is San Jose. So it's 81 in the summer. Then it's like 90 in what we horribly call Indian summer. I don't know why Indians lay claim to September and October, because white people claim July, I guess. And then winter comes in San Jose and it's what? 69? I mean, you know, they grow wine there. How cold can it get? He suggests homeowners put up a temporary plastic or metal fence around their lawn. And you want to make it look like you're in the movie Winter's Bone. You want to look like you're in the fucking Ozarks. By all means, put up a plastic fence around your house. Maybe you could have a pool and a swing set with one broken chain so that the thing hangs off with the swings hanging off half-assed and never, ever fucking gets fixed. Why don't you do that, too? Why don't you park your truck up on blocks in front of your fucking house like it's a casino in Sault Ste. Marie, okay? Why don't we do that to make the neighborhood look a little fucking better? Why don't you have a refrigerator that's dead, but you've taken the door off and just leave it laying there so that it just sucks up fucking water when it pours rain and shit like that? Whatever you do, don't approach them, as they can be dangerous. Yes. It will continue as long as there's a food source here, says Pangelina. They will keep on coming back. They want to get those tasty grubs. Will you stop saying grubs? In San Jose, it's illegal to shoot and kill wild pigs. Whew, there's a load off my mind. Every time I go there... And Jennifer and I often stop in San Jose at another taco place that I'm not going to tell you the name of to get tacos. Is that your whole life, Greg? Yes, it's National Taco Day. That's why I'm telling you about La Superica and Los Agaves in Santa Barbara. If you go to San Francisco, La Taqueria. And if you go to San Jose, I'm not telling you the name of this place, but it's right off the freeway and it's good. And they're open, no, not too late, about 8-ish. And there I would get the carnitas. But then I would get the carnitas pretty much anywhere. In San Jose, it's illegal to shoot and kill wild pigs unless you're a sociopath, in which case, whatever. You have a license from Fish and Wildlife, and then only in traps. What? So you can kill a wild pig in a trap? You can trap a wild pig and then shoot it? Is that what I meant to understand? That was the most oblique sentence. For now, neighbors say they're looking at fixing the fence and being extra vigilant. Well, as you know, the price of no pigs on your property is extra vigilance. I believe it was General George S. Patton who first put that forward when he was taking the Third Army across Germany and liberating Bastogne. By the way, Patton didn't speak the way George C. Scott did in the movie. George C. Scott affected that awesome growl, right? And no son of a bitch ever here. Patton talked in a high-pitched voice. Dave Stewart. Supposedly Lincoln did, too. Who's Dave Stewart, Greg? He was a baseball pitcher. Never mind. But supposedly Lincoln, you know how Daniel Day-Lewis is doing Lincoln in the movie? And he's kind of talking like this. He's got a high-pitched voice like that. That's the Patton spoke that way, too. But the difference was Lincoln didn't call people cocksuckers and motherfuckers in his speeches, and Patton did, which they took out of the movie, but he really did. Give it to him loud and dirty, and then it sticks, I believe, was what he said. Someone has written me here at the Porpoise. Alex Max Metric from New York has written me. Dear Mr. Proops, hi, Alex. Thank you for the latest, Max. It was funny and depressing and scary and worth my time as ever. A couple points in the podcast might be worth some clarification. First, the easy one. Debbie Wasserman Schultz chose not to run for Senate. The Democratic nominee this year is Patrick Murphy. It's Florida, and it wouldn't matter, but for Rubio is currently leading in the polls. And let me just jump away from that to show you that I do research. Jennifer looked this up for this morning. One of the bigger congressional primary days in the summer calendar Debbie Wasserman Schultz beat Tim Canova, a law professor. So, yes, she is running for Congress. Sorry I said Senate. She's going to run for her congressional seat there. Second, about Nikita Khrushchev. I don't think you were fair. You know, when I weigh in on tyrants and dictators, let me say, first of all, Max, Khrushchev's numbers were nowhere near as good as Putin's. Putin, according to the Trump, is running at 87% approval. Now, mind you, it reminds me of the old Wizard of Id cartoon. Here's the new voting machine. If you press this lever, you can vote for the king. And what happens if you press this lever? You have one hand left to press the other lever. The reason why Russian dictators have such high approval ratings is you're not allowed to not approve of them because you'll be sent to a gulag or whatever, and you'll have to eat fish eyes like Alexander Solzhenitsyn did in that book I read in high school. Khrushchev, I don't think you were fair. We will bury you. And he pounded his. Yes, he said, we will bury you. But according to him, he looked this up. He was protesting a speech by Philippine President Sumulong. My experience with Philippine men contradicts that, which is hilarious that he wrote that. More importantly, Khrushchev was a reformer and would-be peacemaker. President Eisenhower, a warrior with no love of war, President Eisenhower was the one who warned us that we should beware the military-industrial complex, which is what he said when he was leaving the White House. Now, Eisenhower knew everything about the military-industrial complex because he was in charge of organizing D-Day for the Allied forces. He was not the supreme commander of the Allied forces during the war. Everyone thinks he was, but it was Marshall in the Pacific and Clark in the Europe, I think. Anyway, he was quite high in the chain of command, obviously, and he had the enormously challenging task of coordinating French, Canadian, British, American, a gigantic sea invasion, the largest landing invasion of all time, da 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 da. And he was quite successful at it. Yes, it cost a zillion lives, but we were able to retake Europe. Going back to Patton, the Germans absolutely believed Patton was going to lead that invasion, which is why they had Patton flying around Europe through the whole of the war and using him as a decoy. He had slapped a soldier and he was too contentious and controversial to run the troops. And the Germans just couldn't believe that you would do that to someone who was such an intense tank commander. They thought, well, fuck it, of course they'll have Patton. So they were chasing Patton around all over the place and refused to believe that the invasion was going to be where it was. And they had all their troops at Calais. I'd bet you didn't know this was going to be a World War II fucking episode. This episode's in black and white if you're listening. In any case, let's see here. Most importantly, Khrushchev, Eisenhower was to meet Khrushchev, and this is the salient part. Ike was president twice. Brown versus the Arkansas Board of Education happened during his watch. He was not moving swiftly to make civil rights a reality in this country. He was a conservative Republican, but by the measure of what we've got running as a Republican right now, Eisenhower looks like Jimmy Carter married Jane Fonda. They were supposed to meet in May 1968 in what might have been the most important peace conference in the 20th century. And then, because Max is a student of history, he writes, START 1 and 2 were terrific achievements. You may remember the START talks. Carter was in the second one. Congress would never pass that treaty. START 1 did get passed. On May 1st, U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers, you know the rest. Francis Gary Powers was flying a U-2 and was shot down by the Russians, taken captive, and we had to get him out of that situation. Francis Gary Powers was a famous Cold War casualty. He was a pilot. U-2s are surveillance aircraft. So, years ago, I'm in, we've talked about it way too much in the show, but I'm talking about it anyway again. We were in Oman at an airbase, and I was with Charles Esten, or did I tell this one already? I was with Charles Esten, who you know as Deke on Nashville, which is now on CMT, formerly of ABC. And Charles is in every Kevin Costner movie, and he played in the 12 Days in October Kevin Costner movie, which is the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He played a U-2 pilot in the movie, not Francis Gary Powers, but another U-2 pilot. And we were on the U-2 base, and we get there, and we're with Drew Carey and everybody. And when we landed, all the troops had Drew Carey masks they were holding up, and Kathy Kinney, Mimi masks and stuff. So they were very excited. We got to the U-2 barracks where the planes were stashed, and the U-2 pilots were there. And they went, are you fucking kidding me? Chip Esten. And they fucking put him in a U-2, which you weren't supposed to do. I have a picture of Chip wearing a helmet, pretending to fly a U-2 aircraft, because the U-2 crew was so goddamn excited that a person who had played one of them in a movie was there. They were like, Drew, they're like, Drew, fine, whatever. Chip Esten's here. And he played a U-2 pilot in 12 Days in October. And that was hilariously exciting to me. And of course, Chip was chuffed. He's got his thumbs up in the picture, right? He's got the white helmet on and everything. Mind you, we weren't allowed to get in there. They're completely classified. They're spy planes. It was great. Remember, it was also Khrushchev who finally denounced Stalin and his crimes. Quiet riot, Max. You've taken me to the limit on this one. And he's also given me a link to the U-2 story. Thanks again for the great works and good works. Thank you, Max, for your kind contribution to this week's show. It's always important to correct the record since no one cares really, but I do. Here it was. Francis Gary Powers, 1960. Let's see here. The U-2 apocalypse. On the eve of the Paris summit, that was it. CIA pilot Francis Gary Powers took off from a base in Pakistan, bound for another base in Norway. And he got within 2,900 miles of Soviet airspace near the city of Sverdlovsk Oblast in the Ural Mountains. His plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile. He ejected, parachuted safely to the ground, captured by the KGB, held for interrogation. They put the plane on display, the parts that survived. Powers provided the Soviets concrete proof the United States had been conducting the flights. It was not immediately clear. Then they canceled the summit. Eisenhower denied any knowledge of the spy program. Does that sound familiar? They shot a guy down and had him in captivity. And he was all dashing. And there's his picture. You can see his groovy 1960 black crew cut and his white shirt and his black tie and everything. He's a bit of a hero. For being shot down. But you notice that they call him, and this is from a government site, by the way. He gave me, this is the Office of the Historian for the Department of State. That was the link Max sent me. It's called state.gov milestones. And he said it contains some, how did he put it? Some measure of truth. There's an excellent State Department webpage that is reasonably factual. Which is all you can expect from the government. And it is reasonably factual and quite interesting indeed. The Cold War seems so insignificant over time. And then now, what with Putin being so popular with Trump and obviously backing him in this race, and the Russian hacks of American of the DNC and different things in the United States. I think Russia's more involved with our politics than they probably have been since the 60s or 70s. And it's a terrible state of affairs. Let's see here. One of the bigger congressional primary days in the summer. Oh, we've already read that. Let's move on here. Greg, this is from Callan. Longtime fan of your stand-up and improve. Yes, it says improve. And I'm going to read the sentence the way I think it should be written, which I think is not how she meant it. I think she meant to say, I'm a longtime fan of your stand-up and improv. But this is how I think she should have written it. I'm a longtime fan of your stand-up and improve. No. I would exhort you. I would implore you. I would beseech you. Please, Greg, improve, won't you? I'd like to. And recently I discovered the podcast through your appearances on Harmontown. Harmontown is an obscure podcast that only broadcasts in Eastern Europe on alternate Wednesdays. I don't know who writes it. I don't know anyone on it. Being 26 and from Nashville, I grew up a Braves fan. I was a kid in the Glavine Schmaltz Maddox era. Of course you were. And I was an adult during that era. And I will say that Greg Maddox was a superb pitcher. And when he was 40, I saw him pitch for the Dodgers. Me and my friend Debbie Durst went to Dodger Stadium, and he threw a fucking two-hitter against the Giants. Jesus. He must have won 350 games in the big leagues. But I'm telling you, during the era when you were a fan, Callen, he had a big strike zone. The umpires gave him a huge strike zone. I'm not saying, you know, I'm just saying. You know, many people feel... Believe me, many people feel his strike zone was big. I don't know. Maybe my Second Amendment people can take care of it. Well, I don't know. Whatever. I appreciate your condolences. And my heart was full of bursting last week when wandering around Turner Field for the last time. And this is where the story gets good. I came upon the kids' batting cages by the $12 hot dogs and $27 aluminum pint bottles of piss light beer. That was a joke she wrote. I thought that was funny. $27. I stood for nearly half an hour watching this group of three sisters, 10, 7, and 5, line up again and again to bat. They put 16-year-old peach scruff mustachioed obnoxious bros to shame by never hitting less than 7 of 10 pitches, while the young males averaged 2 or 3 hits per turn. They were remarkable, and there were mutterings throughout the crowd to the effect that the Braves should sign these girls because we might need them to beat the Phillies tonight. I relayed the story to my bartender later that night at a vile chain bar that I relied solely on their skimpy uniforms for their lovely female employees. I was without a car, and they had what was literally the only bottle of vodka within walking distance of my hotel. Your story has moved my heart. And I agree with you that having to go to bars where they make the female staff wear skimpy outfits is a terrible, terrible experience. There's one called the, I'm not going to say the name of it, but they do it. I wrote in my book, The Smartest Book in the World, which you can buy at popular prices online. And yes, the paperback comes out in February, the second week of February. They don't make men wear skimpy outfits in bars. They really don't. You don't go into bars and there's guys walking around with a butt plug and like plastic pants on and stuff with paint on their nipples. And yet you can go to almost any sports bar or those Hooter type places and there's girls wearing, at Hooters they wear shorts with pantyhose under them, which is, I don't even begin to understand that. And then there's other bars where they wear like little kilts or skimpy outfits. It's just horrible. What are you against good looking women? How come we can't grow up? She's complaining about it, so you understand what I'm talking about here. Her eyes filled, the only bottle of vodka. Her eyes filled up with more pride than I'd seen in the time it took me to finish my three previous drinks. Hey, I love your style. My friend sent me a quote the other day, and this was it. Men who want to be feminists don't need to be given space in feminism. They need to take the space they have in society and make it feminist. Okay? That's by Kelly Temple. I think we can agree on this, and I thank you for your constant outspokenness and advocacy. You raised the bar for men like me to stand on the right side of history. Next time you're in Nashville, I'd be happy to buy you a vodka-flavored vodka drink with vodka in it. Thank you, Callen Holder. Thank you for writing me. Thank you for being an enlightened male. Now we're going to get to Crump a little bit. We're going to jump around a little bit. This is the week after the debate, and so much has happened. I don't even know where to begin with all y'all. I think the last time we spoke, was it before the debate or after? It was before, wasn't it? No, it was after, because we did Sniffy McAdderall, McSniffle Dog. He's tripled down on everything since then. And, of course, it's been revealed since then that he had illegal dealings with Cuba, that he probably hasn't paid his taxes in 20 years. We know from his 1995 tax form that he took a loss of $912 million, which is the amount of money that if all of the people who listen to this podcast all together, if we all pooled our money, we wouldn't have one iota of $912 million. He blew it in 1 year and then has carried on being an unsuccessful businessman since then and like that. So let's see here. This is what he said this week in Pennsylvania the day after, because he gave a crazy town speech in Pennsylvania the day after. I have a great temperament. It's one of my strongest things. Clinton could be crazy. She could actually be crazy. Now, this is what we call projection. We've talked about it before. Charles M. Blow wrote a tremendous article that he was a terroristic toddler. He's tripled down on everything here. I wanted to go to one little... I'm going to shoot forward and then come back to this part here because the Washington Post wrote this yesterday. Today, rather. About his temperament and things like that. And it was... Well, here's what Graydon Carter wrote. This was in Vanity Fair. Jennifer, give it to me today. It can reasonably argue that the presidency of George W. Bush was an 8-year warm-up act for the final stage of a dumbed-down America. a Trump presidency. You can draw a relatively straight line from the Florida recount of 2000, which took Bush into office, right through to the shambolic Trump campaign. The election of Bush led to the invasion of Iraq, which led to the destabilization in the Middle East, Libya, Egypt, Syria, which led to the migrant crisis, which led to European nationalism, Brexit, and at the tail end of all these disasters, Trump. The fact that his Carney Act has gotten so far will leave the path with a permanent orange stain. He has touched, embraced every third rail in American politics. He's offended, and I apologize if I've left some groups out. African Americans, Native Americans, Mexicans, Jews, Muslims, war heroes. And here Gridden Carter stops and writes, war heroes. Families of war heroes, the disabled, women and babies, and then babies. Through word or action, Trump has promoted gun violence, bigotry, ignorance, intolerance, lying, and just about everything else that can be wrong with a society. And yet he marches on, playing to a constituency that just doesn't seem to care. The thing is, this ramshackle campaign, following a ramshackle business career, has exposed his flaws and failures to the world. And more importantly, to the people he will brush up against for the rest of his life. To them, he's now officially a joke. I suspect he knows this. And if his thin skin on minor matters is any indication, he'll be lashing out with even more vitriol. He is a mad jumble of a man, with a slapdash of a campaign and talking points dredged from the dark corners of the bottom of the internet. I don't think he will get to the White House, but just the fact that his Carney Act has gotten so far along the road will leave the path with a permanent orange stain. Trump, more than ever, more than even the most craven politicians or entertainers, is a bottomless reservoir of need and desire for attention. He lives off crowd approval, and at a certain point that will dim, as it always does to people like him, and the cameras will turn to some other American novelty. When that attention wanes, he will be left with his press clippings, his dyed hair, his fake tan, and those tiny fingers. I couldn't agree with more about that. He's also, there was, was it in the Washington Post, about his latest tweets and whatnot, that his temperament is absolutely insupportable of someone who wants to be president. You don't get up at 5 a.m, all that following the debate, and calling Miss Universe a fat pig, and or what was it, Miss Piggy, and then going on Fox News by phone the next day, and she gained an enormous amount of weight. It was a real problem. Yeah, that's what the real problem is. And then backing up with having Rudy Giuliani and Newt Gingrich and Chris Christie, who are as credible as you could possibly have now of spokespeople, go out and double down on all of the misogyny and hideousness. The toxic male masculinity of Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani. By the way, Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump, and Newt Gingrich have 9 wives between them, because he was starting in about Hillary Clinton's fidelity, and gave one of his great sentences like, "Hillary Clinton, she might cheat on Bill. I don't know." Yeah. 9 wives between them, and all of them known to have cheated on their wives in between. Rudy Giuliani famously used the command center and, I believe, texted his wife their breakup. Newt Gingrich left one of his wives while she had cancer. And Donald Trump was already having an affair with Marla Maples when he left Ivana, mother of Ivanka, mother of America. And so the idea that you're going to use infidelity as a talking point is yet another example of male privilege and toxic masculinity. It's also, of course, the delusionary world that they all live in, where chicks are hot pieces of ass and you get to smoke a cigar, and everything is surf and turf and golf clubs, and making America great means, I don't know, lying to the public a lot and making fat people sad when none of their promises come true. Let's see here. Donald Trump on Monday, this is Harry Reid, I believe. Here it is. No, this is from every newspaper around the country today, because this is, I have a timeline of things he's done and said, but it's so bloody long that the whole show would be about this. He did get up at 5 a.m. after we all found out that he violated the Cuba embargo, and he accused the FBI of giving Hillary Clinton immunity. And then they said he was very proud of being a birther and lying about Obama's birth date for ages. This was the 5:30 a.m. Tweet. Using Alicia M., that's Alicia Machado, who Hillary brought up in the debate as a paragon of virtue, just shows that crooked Hillary suffers from capital letters, bad judgment, exclamation point. Hillary was set up by a con. And then a couple moments later, did crooked Hillary help disgusting, brackets, check out sex tape and past, Alicia M., become a U.S. citizen so she could use her in a debate? This is from Think Progress. The next line in this article is, she doesn't have a sex tape. In fact, Donald Trump is the one with a sex tape. He appeared in a softcore porn. at 2:39 p.m., he defended making those early morning tweets. For those few people knocking me for tweeting at 3 o'clock in the morning, first of all, Crump, if it was few people, why are you bothering to respond to it? Why don't you just rise up above it? Oh, because you have the temperament of an angry squirrel on a meth binge. You perceive every acorn that falls on the ground as a personal slight to your tiny fingers. For those people knocking me for tweeting at 3 o'clock in the morning, at least you know I'll be there awake to answer the call, exclamation point. Yeah, I love Adderall too. You know, when I got to get something done, I'll stay up all night and take it. Then he appeared in a softcore porn movie. This is a timeline the same day. That's at 5:30, 6:30. He says the election could be rigged. Make sure everything is on the up and up. You've been reading. This was he told supporters. I've been reading. You've been reading the same stories as I've been reading. Go to your place and vote and go pick up some other place and go sit there with your friends and make sure it's on the up and up. Because you know what? That's a big, big problem in this country. Nobody wants to talk about. Nobody has the guts to talk about. So go and watch these polling places. Make sure it's on the up and up, please. That would be one hell of a way to lose. I'll tell you right now. There is no voter fraud in this country. We've gone over it again and again and again and again. There's 20 cases in the last 20 years of people using fake IDs. What he wants to do is harass people of color and the old and people that can't defend themselves. He wants his thuggish people that support him go out to voting places and harass and dissuade people from voting that aren't like him. Half an hour later, there was an ad with Ivanka Trump in it. And Ivanka says in the ad, this was to appeal to women. The most important job a woman can have is being a mother. I'll leave that one with you. You can write your own joke about that one. Then he, at 7 p.m., he demanded Obama promise not to pardon Clinton. What day are you talking about, Greg? Because you just keep saying times, but you're not making it clear. This was Friday, September 30th, five days ago. This all happened in one day, by the way. Another damaging report about the Trump Foundation. And subsequent to that, as of yesterday, the New York Attorney General has told the Trump Foundation to cease and desist gathering donations because they're not of charity. They're just taking money. I'm sorry. At 9 p.m., he called the New York Times and said he's going to get nasty. And this is what Trump said. She's nasty, but I can be nastier than she can ever be. Well, that's good to know that Michelle Obama said, when they go high, you low, we go high. And Trump said, I can be nastier than she can ever be. You've already proven that. You don't have to keep telling us that, you bloviating, scampy haired yam. And then the Saturday, October 1st, the New York Times tax return. Then he made fun of Hillary for having pneumonia and did a pantomime of her stumbling to the car when it's been proven, of course, that she's over it. And then he said she could be crazy, which is the kettle calling the pot on many things. Then he said, I don't think she's loyal to Bill. Then came Sunday, and Chris Christie said the not paying taxes story is a very good story for Trump. That was followed up by Rudolph Giuliani calling him a genius for not paying his taxes. I really don't know where the bottom is in this one. There is no bottom. On the upside, ever so briefly, LeBron James, King James to you, endorsed Hillary in a very long op-ed article. And the question has to be raised, when was the last time a superstar athlete wrote a giant article supporting a presidential candidate? What does this tell you? Well, LeBron James was raised by a single mother in a not very rich neighborhood in Ohio. He is a black superstar. He has the ear of many different communities, sports fans, black people, people in general, because he's famous. And he's using that platform to campaign against Trump. So I think I'll leave the conclusions to you. I know. Why can't your sports people just dance for you and play for you and make baskets and make you happy? And why do they have to make you think and stuff all the time? I know. It is so hard being a person. Daniel Dale, who covers everything for the Toronto Star and has been on the Trump train. If you go to his Twitter feed, which is ddale, at ddale8, he goes through everything false that Donald Trump says every day. This is from yesterday, and these are the things he said that were false on Saturday. We have the support of Hispanics and the African Americans. The New York Times illegally obtained his tax information. A reporter opened her mail. I believe her name, I've forgotten her last name, Suzanne Craig. Suzanne Craig was on telly last night. An anonymous envelope came to her mailbox at the New York Times, sent from, awesomely, Trump Tower. So Marla Maples, maybe, I don't know who. We're all hoping it was someone who is a janitor or maybe a lower person on the totem pole there who is abused by him, who somehow found these pages. I don't know why they would have three pages of his 1995 tax return. But for those of you who always make fun of mail and call it snail mail, snail mail just saved your universe this week. Also, the support of the African Americans and Hispanics. He's polling at under 20% with Hispanics, and he's polling at under 4% with African Americans. So let me just read you what he said. We have the support of Hispanics and the African Americans. Now, if I was supporting you 2% of the time, would you call that my support? Falsely said, they said she's worth $250 million, reports the Washington Post. The Clintons' personal disclosure, they reported assets ranging from 11.3 to 52. This number does not reflect the homes that they own. Falsely said, she also wants to shut down production of shale energy. That's not true. Falsely said, we don't make anything anymore. Manufacturing represents 12% of the U.S. economy. Falsely said, the U.S. has China trade deficits of $400-500 billion. It's $367 billion, but you know how he always upgrades. By the way, he was going to save the steel industry, and he's making fun of Hillary for being against the steel industry. He went to China to buy all his steel, and he went over there in a very devious way. Kurt Eichenwald, David Fahrenthold, and Daniel Dale are your waiters to go on if you want to read all about it. And, of course, trading with Cuba when there was an embargo against Cuba. Let's see. I'll just give you one or two more, and then... like the European Union, she wants to erase our borders. Clinton is not proposing to erase borders or create anything like the European Union. Falsely said, it's not like, oh, gee, do you think she's guilty? They've actually admitted she's guilty. No authority has admitted Clinton is guilty of crimes related to her emails. And in fact, you may remember the FBI director, blah, blah, blah. I thought I was never going to have to say emails again. And I haven't. There's a debate tonight. By the time you listen to this, the debate will be over. Do you remember who called it the Thriller in Vanilla? The two whitest people in the world are debating. Yeah. Who was it?
It was Washington Post
reporter. The Washington Post. Mike Pence is a homophobic misogynist who uses Christianity to support his bigotry and narrow-minded viewpoints against everybody. He's not a fan of LGBT rights. He co-sponsored an amendment in 2003 that would prohibit same-sex marriage. 4 years later, he voted against the Employee Non-Discrimination Act. He's made life harder for lower-income families. Pence voted against raising the minimum wage, expanding health coverage. He refused to comply with the Obama administration rules and aiming at reducing prison rape. He wrote to the Department of Justice in 2014 that argued the new rules work only to bind the states and hinder the evolution of even better and safer practices. He supported deporting undocumented children and sick people and favors building a fence on the border. He has decimated access to abortion. If you want to go on my friend Liz Winstead's Lady Parts Justice website, he is an absolute enemy of women. He slashed Planned Parenthood funding, spurred clinic closures, and this part you need to know. In 2014, state funding for Planned Parenthood had been cut nearly in half from 2005. They were forced to close 5 of the smaller clinics, none of which had ever provided abortions, but they did provide STD testing. Soon, Scott County, Indiana, home to one of the closed clinics, became the hub of an enormous HIV outbreak. Mike Pence paid for the war on Planned Parenthood by having an HIV outbreak. 4,300 residents in that county, 150 active HIV counts, a shocking epidemic inflicted on people of little else but their addictions. 1/4 of the residents live below the poverty line. That's the kind of person Mike Pence is. And yes, he will use Jesus to hide behind all of this all the time. He also, in 2015, signed a bill permitting business owners to refuse service to gay and lesbian customers due to their religious beliefs. We've talked about it before in the show. If you need to hide behind the Bible to be awful to people, then I don't dig your Bible as much as you do. Now, getting off the crump crane for a while and moving on to something more illuminating. John Lewis has written a comic book or a graphic novel, if you will, for those of you who are into that thing, and it's called March. We heard him talking about it the other day on the radio. If you don't know who John Lewis is, I was reading from his speech at the African American Museum at the Smithsonian last week. He's a civil rights icon. He's a congressman from Georgia. At the dawn of civil rights, Lewis marched fearlessly into the maws of the Jim Crow South through angry racist mobs and truncheon wheeling state troopers, armed with nothing more than the courage of the righteous and unconditional love in his heart. He shed his own blood to shame this country into living up to the founding promise that all men were created equal. This remains a work in progress. At 76, he's the last man alive who spoke at the March on Washington in 1963. That was the I Have a Dream Day. He is the last of the so-called Big Six, the six leaders of the civil rights movement shepherded by Martin Luther King. And as such, he is the closest thing we have to an American Gandhi still standing. 2 weeks ago, he was given the Liberty Medal at the National Constitutional Center on Independence Mall in Philadelphia. You may have also noticed he led the sit-in so that they would vote for gun control in Congress. He was the person who led that. The kernel of the ideas for March came from Lewis' youngest aide, Andrew Aden, a self-described comic book nerd who worked his way up from the mailroom to become the congressman's policy advisor and digital director. When the idea was broached in 2008, it was scoffed at by the senior members of Lewis' staff, but Lewis was intrigued. "Don't laugh," he said. "I read the Martin Luther King comic and started studying the way of peace, the way of love, philosophy, discipline, and I finally said yes to Andrew if he did it with me." From the beginning, the intent of March was to use Lewis' inspirational story to solve the nine-word problem. The vast majority of students graduating from high school only know nine words about the civil rights movement: Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and I Have a Dream. That's what his aide Aden says. "Our goal was to defeat the nine-word problem because you can't understand the politics of today without understanding the civil rights movement." Now, just to orient you, President Obama and Hillary Clinton did not found ISIS. These are all things Trump has said in the last week. The 1990s was not the worst time since the Depression. It was, in fact, the very opposite of that. It was the most booming economic time. Everything Trump says is a lie intended to fool you and say things that the military is in shambles. It is not. We are running very successful raids all the time against ISIL. The generals that he claims to know more than, he does not know more than the generals who are running the military. He also suggested that people with post-traumatic stress syndrome who were in the military this week were, I want to get the wording wrong. They weren't up to it, basically. Having had a father who was not all the way balanced and had been in the military for a long time, umbrage is not what I take. It's just absolutely a new low and a series of new lows. In any case, that's to orient you about that. So when Trump says things like black people have never had it worse, they have. They were in bondage. They were slaves for 400 years. And then after the slavery was Jim Crow segregation. And after the segregation came the civil rights movement, which John Lewis was a part of. And that's what I wanted to orient you. In the early 60s, black people in the American South lived in constant fear. This is John Lewis speaking in the comic book. They were afraid. There were people afraid to come to mass meetings, to come to rallies. So we had them in the churches where people felt safe. We heard people saying, "People are meeting in the church. It must be all right." Then they started burning down the churches. That was in regard to the song I played you last week by Nina Simone, "Mississippi Goddamn," was about a church bombing in Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Mississippi. The core of the young people, the students, we lost that sense of fear. I know I lost that sense of fear, and we didn't know what we'd be beaten, where we'd be left bloody and unconscious. They would single out the white participants for especially brutal treatment because they saw them as betraying the white race. On the freedom rides, on the march from Selma to Montgomery, we were prepared to die for what we believed in. We wrote our wills in case something were to happen to us. We didn't know whether we would return or not. Keep in mind that Donald Trump has the endorsement of David Duke, who is the former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, speaking of betrayals to the white race. When I see the people that react to Donald Trump's words at those rallies, I see the same look in their eyes that I saw in the eyes of Sheriff Clark and his posse. A look that says, "You're not a part of us. You're not a part of the American family. You come from someplace else." When Trump talks about building a wall to lock certain individuals out, people rallied. They screamed and yelled. It reminded me of some of the rallies that I saw on television for, brackets, infamous racist segregationist Alabama Governor George Wallace during the 60s. Now, as we've discussed on the show, George Wallace recanted after he was shot and went to all the people, including the black people that he had kept out of the schools in Alabama, and apologized to them. He also went around Alabama to black churches and personally asked for forgiveness. So you can change. Crump is not going to, but George Wallace certainly did after he was shot. He came to realize how terribly he had treated all of his black constituents and all of black people in his life. Let's see here. I've said it over and over again, what I like to call a nonviolent revolution in America during the last 50 years, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. I think the Trump campaign is trying to take us back to another place, another time. And we've come so far, made so much progress. I don't think we can afford to go back. We have to go forwards and continue to be what Dr. King called the beloved community, where we lay down the burden of division, the burden of hate, and create an American community at peace with itself. He's absolutely worth reading about. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to hit on it ever so briefly and just kind of cover it with a few other things. Gary Johnson is running for president, and you really, really shouldn't entertain any notion of voting for him, even if you detest Hillary Clinton because she made your pee-pee hurt or whatever the reason is. Or you work for Adult Swim and you just can't countenance any women creating conflict in your life. Gary Johnson, just understand that it's not what you think it is. Libertarian doesn't mean anybody gets to do what they want. His agenda is extraordinarily right-wing. He doesn't want any controls on guns at all. No gun control. None gun control. Do you follow what I'm saying? There's an article in the National Memo called Meet Gary Johnson's Money Man. Jennifer gave it to me. I'm not going to read it to you. It's quite long and detailed. If you want to know who's backing this guy and where the money's coming from, as we always say, follow the money. There you are. When he ran for president on the Libertarian ticket, there's also an article in Rolling Stone called Why Gary Johnson Shouldn't Be President. And that's what I'm quoting from here. 1.2 million Americans voted for him. That's 0.99% of the total votes cast that year. Excuse me. That's quite a considerable, that's almost 1% of the votes. Today, Johnson's polling nearly 10 times higher than that. They've got him at 9%. It's just shocking. And then I know some of you are going to go, well, but it's because these are the two worst candidates that ever ran in the history of presidential politics. No, these are the one worst candidate that ever ran in the history of presidential politics against one of the best candidates that ever ran. Gary Johnson, on the other hand, is one of the worst. If you believe college should be tuition free, Johnson disagrees. I would not believe colleges or universities should be free. They would be too expensive. You're against big money in politics. He is for Citizens United. I think Citizens United comes under the First Amendment. You're against fracking. I have spoken to my former environmental secretary, and what he says regarding fracking is that it's only 10% effective. Number one, it would be more effective. It could have a much higher yield. So it sounds very pragmatic to me. Johnson doesn't really know the specifics of the trade deal, but supports it nonetheless. He's against the Keystone Pipeline. No, he's for it. He doesn't think the minimum wage is too low. Oh, God, I don't even want to read this to you. It's so fucking crazy. Minimum wage, look, I think everyone's missing the boat. Why doesn't he raise it to $75 an hour? Well, of course he can't raise it to $75 an hour, because then prices would go way up. All right, I've had enough. He's opposed to family paid medical family leave. He's opposed to any restrictions when it comes to firearms. None. The Affordable Care Act, he swore he would repeal Obamacare. I think that very simply, we can't afford it. The long-term solution to healthcare is a free market approach to healthcare. We had that. We had that. That's why it costs $1 zillion to go to the hospital for 1 hour. Also, in the last few days, you may have noticed there was the Aleppo moment. He didn't know who Harriet Tubman was a week ago. And then he doubled down on the Aleppo moment, which is a terrible thing to say, by saying it was this today, he said, it's not important that he knows where countries are, because that's how wars get started, because politicians actually know where the country is they're going to bomb, and this would keep him from doing it. So, that's enough of him. Let me just put it this way. Toxic masculinity is real. Male privilege exists. And Trump and Gary Johnson are absolutely the emblem, flag-bearing, flag-waving in front of the parade. They are Bacchus at the fucking Mardi Gras parade. And Roger Ailes, Paul Manafort, who are known abusers of women, known abusers of women. I'm not making it up, and I'm not exaggerating, and I'm not going, well, many people say, believe me. I don't know, right? I'm giving you the straight dope. This is toxic masculinity. This is what male privilege looks like. It's guys bloviating, saying whatever they want, being as stupid and mediocre as they can possibly be, being erroneous about everything, making up things, taking unsupportable positions against women and children, taking unsupportable positions for firearms, taking unsupportable positions that destroy people's rights, alienating more than half the population. The world is not made of white men, and the United States is not made of white men. We are in the minority. So the idea that we have to keep paying lip service to them, the idea that we keep having to listen to them, the idea that we keep having to subscribe to their crackpot, lunatic, shittily fucking formed, uninformed, bullshit, horrible ideas, has got to stop. And stop thinking about voting for Gary Johnson. He's not helpful. It's not a protest vote. It makes you an asshole, okay? What about voting for Trump? Honey, if you're still thinking about that, I'm just excited you're listening to the show. I want to read you something Eve Ensler wrote, and then we're going to get to a couple of important things, and then we're going to go. Eve Ensler wrote the Vagina Monologues. In case you don't know who she is, she's a playwright. What were the Vagina Monologues? Well, The Vagina Monologues is a play that she wrote about women taking agency back over their own bodies. It was an enormous smash. Off the back of it, there was the Marijuana Logs, and there was, I think Richard Herring did a one about dicks in England called Talkin' Cock. That's how influential it was. She's a very intelligent, enlightened person. This is an article she wrote for The Guardian today. Also, who had her on the other night? Lawrence O'Donnell, when because Trump says vagina costs a lot. So, of course, he brought the expert on vaginas in, Eve Ensler. Because in our country, every woman's not an expert on vaginas. We've designated one woman to be the spokesperson. Donald Trump's not a leader or a presidential candidate. He is an outcome, a viral manifestation of a serious malignant illness. He is the mirror of our emptiness, the emptying out that has been happening to our country for a very long time. He is the outcome of a two-party system that has consistently ignored the needs and wishes of the majority of Americans for generations. He is the manifestation of celebrity culture, where those that have everything are worshipped for their shiny success, and in the world of celebrity, that shininess is a stand-in for principles, substance, and moral values. Who supports Donald Trump? No, she didn't write that. That's a crap part line there. He is personality over planning, symbol over substance, insipidness over insightfulness. He is the outcome of the rich being able to buy anything, including our democracy. He's the outcome of centuries of underlying, unaddressed, massively denied, and metastasized racism. He is the hatred of the poor and the needy, the denigration of immigrants and those seeking refuge from the devastation of U.S. wars and imperialism. He is the outcome of an insidious exceptionalism, the bedrock belief that American lives are more precious and valuable than any others, that those we stigmatize, bomb, torture, murder, control, invade, and whose economies we trash, whose resources we devour, whose futures we steal. He is the outcome of fear, which masquerades as bullying. He is the manifestation of patriarchy and the endlessly indoctrinated belief that only a father will save us, even though the mainly men who have been determining reality for this country and the planet have led us to near ruin. He is the outcome of high-tech fantasy, virtual disconnection, TV reality shows. He is proof of the duplicity of corporate-sponsored media that claim neutrality while reaping profits from propping up racists, tyrants, fascists, haters, and those who would seek to destroy the country. He is the outcome of an insanely violent culture, increasingly unkind, with more bullying, that normalizes cruelty, industrializes punishment, and declares endless war on its own citizens. He is the consolidation of a government that devotes huge portions of its budget to an imperial military rather than feeding and educating its own people, that wreaks havoc on the world rather than fighting climate change, that promotes the pillaging of the earth rather than ending violence against the people who inhabit it, that forces working people to police the world rather than providing them with meaningful work. He's the product of a country with the most number of armed citizens in the world, where the average of 89 firearms for every 100 people leads to more deaths at the hand of fellow countrymen every year than international terrorists have killed ever. I'll read you this one, and then we'll move down to the bottom of the article here. He is the outcome of the piece. He's the outcome of a country where police consistently murder black women and men with little to no repercussion, and millions are living in perpetual incarceration. He's the outcome of corrupt, self-seeking, extremist politicians who ignore the Constitution and make it their business to refuse any meaningful legislation from getting passed. That means this current Congress, who met for a couple weeks and are back on holiday without passing a Zika virus bill, without passing a gun control bill, and without affirming Justice Garland. He is the outcome of a world divided between winners and losers. He is an outcome of fatigue and privilege and disenchantment and hopelessness and exclusion. He is the outcome of cynicism and imposed belief there's nothing we can really do to overcome this corporate neoliberal, I hate the word neoliberal, imperialist, racist, sexist, homophobic, earth-hating, transphobic system. This is what I wanted to read to you. The moment of America has arrived. This is our reckoning, our karma come to roost. It is way beyond the question of who we are voting for. It's a question of who we are. What is America? What kind of country do we want this to be? What values and principles do we hold and cherish? What we will do and what lengths we will go to, what collective imagination we will employ, what mighty love we will summon to ensure the ending of this violence, this hate, this destruction of our Mother Earth, this grotesque inequality of wealth, this mad and ferocious drive to our end. Here is what Donald Trump is not. He's not us. He's not all of us. He's not the best of us. He is not inevitable. Let us take Trump at his word. Let him be our unifier. I thought that was well put, and I've been saying it. The light's been cast now. The cockroaches are scurrying all around. Trump will be the one who unifies us against all of the badness in his obverse, hideous way. Jennifer went to see Eva Hesse. Eva Hesse was a sculptress, if you will. She died quite young in her 30s. She got the brain cancer. In the 50s and 60s, she did a lot of good work. We went to the, I've just forgotten the name. Hauser and Wirth Museum, downtown Los Angeles. They had a gallery, the Hauser and Wirth Gallery. And they had an enormous exhibit that was all women artists. And even Eva Hesse was on display there. She's a very enlightening figure. She's an artist who, if she'd lived, might have gathered even greater fame than she did, because men dominate the world of art. And in her day, there would be one woman in a show, if any, and the whole show would be art, would be men. And now, of course, we've come to realize that women are really good at a bunch of things, like talking and painting and stuff. In 1964, this is from the New York Times, when Eva Hesse went to Germany with her husband, the sculptor Tom Doyle, she was a talented 28-year-old painter with a blue-chip education. She went to Yale and Cooper Union. She was widely recognized as a major artist, a maker of category-confounding forms, abstract and visceral, minimalist and feminist, sculptural and painterly, that have lost none of their powers in the decades since. Marcy Begleiter has done a moving documentary called Eva Hesse, and it talks about her, in, what, as the Times calls it, tragically foreshortened life, but it focuses on the years of artistic emergence. And the people they talk to, this is about the documentary, are middle-aged or older, mostly dressed in 21st century studio or academic mufti. Hesse, in contrast, is a revenant from a cooler, smokier, scruffier decade, eternally and intriguingly youthful, at times resembling the actress Dakota Johnson. She appears mainly in black and white still photographs. When her voice is heard in a snip of audio tape. Ms. Begleiter has made ample and judicious use of Hesse's letters and diaries. These selections, along with the pictures, create a powerful illusion of immediacy, a sense of the personality disclosed and obscured by art. She veered from heroic confidence to crippling doubt, as many artists do. She seemed capable of remarkable, clarity, warmth, and humor. Among her closest confidants was Saul LeWitt, the scholarly, sphinx-like conceptualist visionary, who was the subject of his own documentary by Chris Tarrant a few years ago. And they had an enormous correspondence, and that's part of the documentary as well. Hesse was born, this is what I wanted to get to about her. Obviously, she's all these things and a wonderful artist. She was born to a Jewish family in Hamburg in 36. She and her sister left Germany on a Kinder transport train. Kinder transport was how the Nazis got the Jewish children out of Germany. Their parents managed to escape the Nazis, and so did they, but many of their relatives were killed during World War II, and their mother committed suicide. The Holocaust was never an overt theme in her work. The filmmaker traces the shadow it cast on her life, especially because she moved to Germany with Tom Doyle, because he received a commission from a German industrialist to stay there and work. So she had the opportunity on the one hand to not have a job to follow her muse and do her work. But on the other hand, she had to live in Germany, where she had to leave as a child being chased by the Nazis. So the duality, the dichotomy, whatever you wish to call it, the different poles in her life, make her an undeniably, one, salient artist, and two, amazingly moving. The film is frank, so the picture's called Eva Hesse. If you see it, it might be playing at an art gallery near you. It's playing in Los Angeles at the, over in Westwood.
The Hammer.
At the Hammer Museum. Here's one of the letters, and Jennifer wanted me to read this from Saul LeWitt to Eva Hesse. And it's what we're always talking about on the show when I'm telling you guys to get up and do your work. Now, mind you, I haven't done any work in a long time, so I have a lot of fucking nerve. But I still subscribe to this because I believe you should do your work. Dear Eva, it will be almost a month since you wrote to me and have possibly forgotten your state of mind. I doubt it, though. You seem the same as always, and being you, hate every minute of it. Don't. Learn to say fuck you to the world once in a while. You have every right to. Just stop thinking, worrying, looking over your shoulder, wondering, doubting, fearing, hurting, hoping for some easy way out. Struggling, grasping, confusing, itching, scratching, mumbling, bumbling, grumbling, humbling, stumbling, numbling, rambling, gambling, tumbling, scumbling, scrambling, hitching, hatching, bitching, moaning, groaning, honing, boning, horse shitting, hair splitting, nitpicking, piss trickling, nose sticking, ass gouging, eyeball poking, finger pointing, alleyway sneaking, long waiting, small stepping, evil eyeing, back scratching, searching, perching, besmirching, grinding, grinding, grinding away at yourself. Stop it. And just do. From your description and from what I know of your previous work, the work you're doing sounds very good. And then he moves on. I have much confidence in you, and even though you are tormenting yourself, the work you do is very good. Try to do some bad work, the worst you can think of, and see what happens. But mainly relax and let everything go to hell. You're not responsible for the world. You are only responsible for your work. I think I said it in so many words a couple of months ago on the show. The world is going to go on. You're not responsible for making the entire world better, but you are responsible for yourself. And if you're trying to create right now and you're stuck, get down to it. I do seem to understand your attitude somewhat anyway, because I go through similar process every so often. I have an agonizing reappraisal of my work. We all do. It's a terrible fault. I would like to see your work and will have to be content to wait until August. I've seen photos of some of Tom's new things. My work has changed since you left and is much better. I wish you could be there. Much love to you both. I think it's that first paragraph is astounding, and I would repeat it to you. And not all of it, just this part. Stop grinding, grinding, grinding away at yourself. Stop it and just do. Eva Perez, of course. I mean, Eva, I just made her the prime minister of Israel. Eva Hesse is looking over us all. Yeah, and she's gorgeous, as you can see there. Very attractive. I don't know if I have time to get into Shimon Peres. Let me just briefly touch on it here. Shimon Peres passed away. It wasn't a tragedy. He was 92. You need to know this about Shimon Peres. When the country of Israel was founded, he was there with David Ben-Gurion, Moshe Dayan, with Golda Meir, the people that founded the state of Israel in 1948. Now, I know your immediate reaction, because a lot of you are thoughtful, sharing, caring liberals, is you're going to go, but Israel's really mean to Palestine. And yes, that has happened over the years. Obviously, it's an ongoing war between them. And yeah, the Intifada happened when Shimon Peres was PM, and all sorts of awful things have transpired. Israeli versus Palestinian, Palestinian versus Israel. Obviously, the Palestinians should have their own state and enjoy their own rights. Having said that, let me put this in perspective for you. No one from the Arab world came to Shimon Peres' funeral. Not one leader from the Arab world. That is anti-Semitism, ladies and gentlemen. The Arabs are Semites too. We're all cousins, right? The head of Hamas, of the PLO came, or rather the Palestinian state, he came and shook hands with Benjamin Netanyahu, Mr. Abbas. That was a very profound moment at the funeral. Everyone from around the world came for Shimon Peres, and no one from the Arab world came, which was a little bit disappointing, quite frankly. They felt he let them down on the ball with the Palestinian state. My feeling would be is that Israel is the only elected democracy there. And that if you look around Israel and every corner, you'll find emirs and sheikhdoms, emirates, kings, and no democracy whatsoever. There are Muslims in the Israeli Knesset. That's their parliament. There are no Jews in any of the governments of any of the Arab nations. Let me just put it to you that way. I'm trying to make it as plain as I can to you, because I know people get very upset about this issue. Israel is our ally. Then why did we sell a zillion dollars in arms to the Saudis? Because they're our ally too. It's real fucking complicated. Israel is a security state that was drawn by the British, and that the Israelis fought for. Jews from all over the world came to start the state in the 40s. They had to fight many wars over the years to keep their sovereignty and freedom and to keep their borders intact. While the entire, you may have noticed, Iraq and Syria had been destabilized by us, Israel is still a country and hasn't broken into pieces. He was 93 years old. He died after he's twice prime minister, minister of defense, foreign affairs, transportation, and until 2014, president, which is the largest ceremonial there. He never left the public stage during Israel's 7 decades. That's why I didn't even know if I wanted to start in on this. I said to Jennifer today, I can't do a proper obituary to Shimon Peres. And she went, he was in politics for 70 years. So you really don't, I don't know where you begin. He was consistent in a search for accommodation with the Arab world. He tried to make peace a million times. You may remember Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. He was also prime minister, was assassinated by a right-wing Israeli who was against Rabin's peace proposals with the Palestinians. That's what gets you killed in this world, wanting peace. A search that in recent years left him orphaned as Israeli society lost interest, especially after 2011, because the Arab Spring did not create an easy situation for Israel. Chosen by parliament to serve a 7-year term, he had a complicated relation with the hawkish government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The presidency gave him a perch with public attention, a reputation for vanity and backroom dealing. I love it. Mr. Peres ended his years in public office as a remarkably beloved figure, never at a loss for a bon mot in his Polish-accented Hebrew, English, and French. He said of his transformations, and I love this, this is fantastic. For 60 years, I was the most controversial figure in the country, and suddenly I'm the most popular man in the land. Truth be told, I don't know when I was happier, then or now. He made, all right, let me read this little thing to you. Then I'm going to read you a little from Obama's eulogy, and then we're going to scootle on to this good night. In his efforts to help Israel find acceptance in a hostile region, Mr. Peres' biggest breakthrough came in 93 when he worked out a plan with the PLO for self-government in Gaza and part of the West Bank, which were occupied by Israel. After months of secret negotiation with representatives of the PLO, conducted with the help of Norwegian diplomats and intellectuals, Mr. Peres persuaded his old political rival, Rabin, then the prime minister, to accept the plan. It became known as the Oslo Accords. Yes, the Oslo Accords were never adhered to. It didn't work out, but he tried to do it. Mr. Peres, who was serving as foreign minister, signed the accords on September 13th on the South Lawn of the White House with Mr. Rabin and their old enemy, Yasser Arafat. If you don't know who he is, he was head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the chairman of the PLO, and with some prodding by Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, shook hands. It was unprecedented and historic. Up till that time, Israel had refused to negotiate directly with the PLO. Mr. Peres broke the taboo and the impasse. What we're doing today is more than signing an agreement. It's a revolution. Yesterday a dream, today a commitment. They all got Nobel Prizes for it. That'll show you how important it was in the day. He also said this. If you have children, you cannot feed them forever with flags for breakfast and cartridges for lunch. You need something more substantial. Unless you educate your children and spend less money on conflicts, unless you develop your science, technology, and industry, you don't have a future. A year later, Mr. Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish gunman upset by the accord. The death elevated Mr. Peres to the post of prime minister. A series of Palestinian suicide bombings undercut his authority, and he lost the election to Netanyahu. And then you may be familiar with Israeli history since then. So I don't want to go into every moment of his career. He was successful in some things, unsuccessful in other things. He helped found the State of Israel, which I think is a profound moment in modern history. And if you don't believe that Israel and the United States' fates are inextricably linked, I would say you were naive, at the very least. There are how many Jews in the world? Several million? And the influence Jews have had in the world, you may have noticed, is rather profound. Sort of like how many black people are there in the United States? 10-11% of the population. And yet, funny. So here's what, speaking of black people, here's what President Obama, who gave a very moving eulogy for Shimon Peres. You can go to Time Magazine and read the whole thing. There was just a couple of paragraphs I wanted to read to you that were very beautiful. Out of the hardships of the diaspora, and if you don't know what the diaspora is, it's Jews were scattered all over the world once upon a time. They were made to leave their countries. And then, of course, the Holocaust did nothing to help the Jews all over Europe, who were slaughtered relentlessly for the entire time. Out of the hardships of the diaspora, he found room in his heart for others who suffered. This is Obama speaking of Shimon Peres. He came to hate prejudice with the passion of one who knows how it feels to be its target. Even in the face of terrorist attacks, even after repeated disappointments at the negotiation table, he insisted that as human beings, Palestinians must be seen as equal to indignity to Jews and must therefore be equal in self-determination. Because of his sense of justice, his analysis of Israel's security, his understanding of Israel's meaning, he believed that the Zionist idea would best be protected when Palestinians too had a state of their own. Of course, we gather here in the knowledge that Shimon never saw his dream of peace fulfilled. The region is going through chaotic time. Threats are ever present. And yet he did not stop dreaming and he did not stop working. Evidently, he put in 18-hour days. By the time I came to work with Shimon, he was in the twilight of his years, although he might have not admit it. I would be the 10th president to sit since Kennedy to sit down with Shimon, to 10th to fall prey to his charms. I think of him sitting in the Oval Office, this final member of Israel's founding generation, under the portrait of George Washington, telling me stories from the past, but more often talking with enthusiasm of the present. His most recent lecture, his next project, his plans for the future, the wonders of his grandchildren. In many ways, he reminded me of some other giants of the 20th century I've had the honor to meet. Men like Nelson Mandela, women like Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. Leaders who have seen so much, whose lives span such momentous epochs that they find no need to posture or traffic in what's popular in the moment. People who speak with depth and knowledge, not in sound bites. They find no interest in polls or fads. As Americans and Israelis, we often talk about the unbreakable bonds between our nations. And yes, these bonds encompass common interests. But we're today reminded that the bonds which matter most run deeper. Anchored in a Judeo-Christian tradition, we believe in the irreducible value of every human being. Our nations were built on that idea. They were built in large part by stubborn idealists and striving immigrants, including those who fled war and fled oppression. We have the capacity to do what is right. Shimon's story, the story of Israel, the experience of the Jewish people, I believe it is universal. It is a story of people who, over so many centuries in the wilderness, never gave up on the basic human longing to return home. Shimon Peres reminds us the state of Israel, like the United States of America, was not built by cynics. I wanted to read you that line because I believe in that too. As you know, I'm an idealist, and that means I'm a failed cynic. We exist because people before us refuse to be constrained by the past or the difficulties of the present. Scripture tells us before his death, Moses said, I like him quoting the Hebrew prophets here, I call upon heaven and earth to bear witness this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life that you and your offspring may live. Uvacha v'chayim, choose life. For Shimon, let us choose life as he always did. Let us make his work our own. And then he talks about his memory and whatnot. Anyway, I hope you will read about Shimon Peres if you get a chance, and the state of Israel, and edumacate yourself about all this jazz, because it's quite important. And the world can be better. And I know that he made a lot of war, but he also tried to stop a lot of war from being made. And that's the most you can do as a leader for a country, much like our own Barack Obama. And like that, one thing you don't want is the world to be run by cynics who go by polls and fads and who react angrily to every little thing. You have been the smartest crowd in the world. I've been the smartest man in the world. Thank you very much for listening. May every page of trivia, such a page, may every velvet rings be a real coupon club. And if you have to buy bonds, make sure they're very bonds. I wish you nothing but that. Thank you.